And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting to the community via 93.3 on the FM dial, as well as the rest of the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca. We are back with commentary on the uprisings in the Arab world, in the Middle East, and also in North Africa, as well as the latest on U.S. NATO intervention. And we have with us today Stephen Gowans. Of course, Stephen Gowans is the author, blogger, commentator, writer, an activist who is on our program, been a regular commentator, gives interviews to many news sources. Let's see if we've got Stephen on the line. Stephen, do we have you here with us?
Hello, Brendan.
Hi, Stephen. Excellent. I'm so glad we have you here, because anyone who's been following the anti-war movement on the issue of intervention in Libya, as well as what's been happening in Bahrain, Yemen, there's a good chance they were reading Stephen Gowans. And, of course, his blog is gowans.wordpress.com. It's entitled What's Left. So if you go to Google, you look up What's Left with Stephen Gowans, G-O-W-A-N-S, you can get his blog. And Stephen has been commenting on the dangers of intervention in Libya, as well as the way the media and the U.S. government has been approaching the uprisings in Bahrain and elsewhere. And what's notable about Stephen is he was doing it before most other commentators were. And Stephen, you made some comparisons, I believe, between Bahrain and Libya, of the kind that people are making now. Again, you were one of the first voices to do so. Back in March, you mentioned the sort of state of martial law that had existed in Bahrain because of the uprisings, and you posted a New York Times article that talked about hundreds of Bahraini troops backed by helicopters and tanks forcefully clearing the capital square, black smoke choking the city, live ammunition being fired. And now we have reports of the torture of opposition demonstrators. So you mentioned that there's all kinds of opportunities for human rights activists to get involved on this issue if we wanted to apply the same criteria to Bahrain as we did to Libya. I mean, what would, else would you say was happening in Bahrain that should have caused it to stand out?
Well, it's very interesting that there's such a difference between the reaction to Bahrain versus Libya.
Well, that's for sure, when you have U.S., French, British, then NATO intervention in Libya. In the case of Bahrain, I think you also talked about political jails, the fact that Bahrain's run by a king and a crown prince. But it's interesting how so much attention was focused on the uprising in Libya itself. Now, I understand there was the crossing over of Saudi Arabian forces into Bahrain. That's not something that garnered a lot of attention. But there are those differences. So what do you think some of the major differences are that led to this military strike against Libya compared to the sort of tolerance given to the crackdown that occurred in Bahrain?
Well, one of the big differences is that Bahrain has had long-standing friendly relations with the United States. It's the home of the U.S. 5th Fleet. And, of course, Libya has had a long, troubled relationship with the United States, and there are no U.S. military bases in Libya. But it's also important to look at the degree to which Bahrain is a profitable place for U.S. corporations and investors to export their goods or services or to export their capital compared to Libya. So, for example, what I did was I took a look at something called the Index of Economic Freedom, which is developed by the Heritage Foundation in the United States. And the Heritage Foundation is a right-wing foundation which is concerned with neoliberal economics and with the extent to which countries provide environments or climates that are welcoming to foreign investment.
Steve, I got to say, you know, if you're a political science student, undergraduate in university, it's hard to avoid this Heritage Foundation Economic Freedom Index. It's treated almost as if it's unbiased or factual, that there's a definite list of nations, some of which are more economically free, others which are what they call less free. So they've got a listing then, right?
Right, and I mean, I suppose it might be, you could say it is an unbiased list, depending on how you want to define economic freedom. The Heritage Foundation defines economic freedom from the perspective of those who are concerned about profit, so investors and corporations. It doesn't define it from the perspective of those who might be concerned about real wages, for example. So what I did was I looked at where Bahrain places on the Index of Economic Freedom versus where Libya does. And also the index will provide you with a lot of detail about the investment and business climate of both countries. What I discovered when I looked at Libya was that Libya was down at the bottom. And it was at the bottom with some notable countries, which are Cuba, Zimbabwe, Venezuela, North Korea, countries that are often, or not often, that are the subject of regime change efforts by the United States and its Western allies. If you look for Bahrain, you'll find Bahrain is in the top 10 in terms of economic freedom. So you dig a little deeper and find out, well, what does economic freedom mean, according to the Heritage Foundation, with respect to these two countries? Well, we look at Libya. What's the Heritage Foundation's problem with Libya? And the Heritage Foundation's problem with Libya provides us with insight into what the problem might be for the kind of economic elite that exerts enormous influence on U.S. foreign policy. So the problems are, number one, Libya will not allow foreign investors to own assets in the country lock, stock, and barrel. So there usually has to be some kind of partnership with Libyan investors. Bahrain, however, will allow anyone, or will allow 100% foreign-owned investment. Taxes in Libya are far higher than they are in Bahrain. In Bahrain, they're ridiculously low. Apart from oil companies, corporations pay no taxes, or virtually no taxes in Bahrain. The personal income tax is minuscule, whereas in Libya, personal income tax can reach as high as 90%.
Okay, so Bahrain is a very investment-friendly climate, especially if you're a Western investor trying to shovel profits back out of the country. I guess Libya is a bit more iffy in that respect. They're on the bottom of this Heritage Foundation list, which sounds kind of like it's a hit list almost, right? Because you said, like, Libya, North Korea, Zimbabwe. If you're at the bottom of that list, you're going to be the subject of U.S. attention, and not in a good way, I guess.
Right, and the other interesting thing, if you look at all of the countries that are at the bottom of the list, ones that are the objects of regime change efforts, like Zimbabwe and North Korea and Venezuela, the complaint about them is that these countries violate human rights, and that's why there's an attempt to change the regimes there, or they're somehow, or they're anti-democratic. That's the case made against Zimbabwe, for example. But, you know, and so the argument could be made that the reason why the West is trying to change the regimes in these countries has nothing to do with their investment climate and their economic policies. It has everything to do with their human rights policies. Well, if that were true, then you might not, or you would expect that you wouldn't find the United States to be one of the higher rated in terms of economic freedom, because the United States really, despite all its boasting about being a champion of human rights, has an atrocious human rights record. I mean, you just have to mention Abu Ghraib or Bahrain or, you know, extrajudicial assassination of its own citizens living abroad, or, you know, detention and arrests without charge. There's a whole litany of human rights violations. If you look at Saudi Arabia is perhaps the worst human rights offender on the planet. So if it's true that, you know, human rights and economic freedom go together, then you would expect to find Saudi Arabia at the bottom of the list, but Saudi Arabia isn't at the bottom of the list. In fact, it's closer to the top.
Well, yeah, the Saudis, they get a free pass, and it seems that the U.S. doesn't have a problem with the crown prince of Bahrain, the king of Bahrain, and they've been given cover smoke for this Saudi Arabian move into Bahrain. And, you know, that's given a lot of justifications. It said, well, you know, Bahrain invited them, or Bahrain is basically a protectorate of Saudi Arabia, so it's okay. So there's excuses as to why that kind of behavior is acceptable. Now, I mean, you pointed out in terms of Libya and Bahrain, there's this economic difference. Investing is a more profitable venture, perhaps, in Bahrain. There's changes they want to make in Libya. Politically as well, of course, Bahrain is a client state of the United States, so you have the Fifth Fleet base there, a very large naval base, so that there's no such comparable facility in Libya.
Right. And, but, yeah. And, but it also should emphasize what's happening in Bahrain, because, I mean, mostly it's ignored. I mean, you have a peaceful uprising in Bahrain that is violently put down, not only by the Bahraini authorities, but by the Saudi troops and tanks, and also the militaries of the other members of the Gulf Cooperation Council. So, I mean, it's kind of interesting that you have this going on the one hand, and you have no-fly zones. You don't have the French government recognizing the Bahraini opposition as the legitimate government. You don't have anyone calling for the Saudi troops to withdraw. And as all of this is happening, we have a no-fly zone in Libya, and, you know, the Benghazi rebels being recognized as a legitimate government now by a growing number of other governments, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, how do you explain this huge hypocrisy and double standard?
Well, I guess this is what Obama and Hillary Clinton meant when they said that these different revolutions and uprisings have to be approached differently on a case-by-case basis. So obviously they intend to treat Bahrain very differently than Libya. And you know, as you said, there's been a lot of attention given to Libya at the same time that very little attention was given to Bahrain. And you didn't just have CNN and Al Jazeera and the U.S. government making statements about Libya, but people that had been associated with the anti-war movement to some degree or part of the left, their focus became Libya as well over the past 2 months and not Bahrain. So I know you've commented on this issue, but there's people like Gilbert Ashkar, others who have come out, you know, you hadn't heard much from them, and then bang, they're talking about Libya and the need for a no-fly zone, the need to protect the Libyans.
Yeah, and I haven't really heard them calling for a no-fly zone in Bahrain, for example, or maybe a no-fly zone over Gaza.
You know, that's a funny thing, actually, because I think Ashkar said, I'll be the first to call for a no-fly zone if Israel strikes Gaza again. And then a few days later, Israel did strike Gaza. I don't think I heard anything from him on that subject.
No, and why did we have to wait for them to strike again to call for a no-fly zone?
Yes.
Inevitable that it strikes would happen. And these people like Ashkar and others, I think, really dislike Gaddafi. They dislike him so much that they're willing to kind of support any kind of unjustified NATO intervention in his country. And some of the reasoning is, I don't think, particularly compelling. For example, Ashkar worries a lot about, or worried about whether there was, you know, a slaughter that was about to happen, and talked about the necessity of stopping the slaughter and justifying the NATO intervention in reference to that impending slaughter. But, I mean, without thinking through the implications, well, if you have a NATO intervention, essentially what you're doing is establishing the conditions for a protracted civil war, which is exactly what's happening now.
That's stopping
and there's lots of concern in establishment circles about, you know, how long is this war going to go on?
Yeah.
So, for example, the U.S. Secretary of Defense foresees that it could drag on for at least until the end of the year. So how many people are going to die as a result of this prolonged civil war? And that's another indication that, you know, the United States and France and Britain, I don't think, really care about the lives of Libyans. Otherwise, they wouldn't have agreed to establish the conditions that have given rise to a protracted civil war.
And certainly, it felt like they're trying to stop perhaps a potential evil from happening, a massacre based on some boastful rhetoric, where by enacting an actual evil, a no-fly zone that leads into military intervention, that leads into ground attacks, that leads into a regime change operation and a protracted civil war. I mean, protecting civilians, right? That's what this is all about. Well, they've already bombed the rebels, and now they've bombed civilians in Tripoli. And, you know, the other week I was talking with Phil Taylor, and he said George Orwell would be proud, or they're really bringing in, you know, Orwellian language, and one of those is protecting civilians, because they justified any attack on Gaddafi's forces by NATO as protecting civilians. And when they helped the rebels by stopping a Gaddafi advance at the beginning of that conflict, they also called that protecting civilians. So it seemed that the civilians were only on the anti-Gaddafi side, or there was no civilians in the rest of the country, and that any attack in support of rebels was protecting civilians. Even that's starting to fall apart now that they've hit the rebels and they've hit civilians within areas that support Gaddafi. So the language is being tortured, I think.
Well, yeah, and those who supported this intervention on both the right and the left have kind of created a story, which I don't think is the correct story. And the story is that what's happening in Libya is a mass uprising. Everyone's rising up against Gaddafi, and that isn't the case. I mean, it's a civil war. He does have some support within the country. He just doesn't have support in other parts of the country where he has historically had little support and has faced a lot of enmity.
Well, the rebels were on the brink of defeat, as most accounts report. That's why they called for the intervention. If they had enough popular support within the country, with the NATO backing they've had, they assuredly would have won by now. I don't think that's been the case. So I guess one of the things that's happening is they're blaming the stalemate or the retreat by the rebels on African mercenaries. This is still happening. It's hard to believe. But actually, I have an Al Jazeera article with me. And you remember Al Jazeera was one of the first outlets to talk about African mercenaries. They were hyping that up, interviewing rebels and people in Libya. And then they had to sort of back down when they realized the consequences it was having, these sort of pogroms. I have one from April 9th right here. Migrants forced to fight for Gaddafi. That's the title of the article, and then it basically interviews a few people who say that they were mercenaries, but it presents no systematic evidence, and they even interview people who said, you know, whenever we run into anyone fighting on Gaddafi's side who's speaking another language and looks black, they're accused of being mercenaries. So there's not empirical basis to this, and there's no what you would call structural evidence or solid evidence, but they keep passing on reports and whatnot. So that's explanation number one of why the rebels are losing the African mercenaries. And the other one, of course, is they need more help from NATO. Some commentators especially have pointed out, I think Glenn Ford on Black Agenda Report and others, that NATO seems to be disciplining the rebels. They stop the airstrikes every now and then to show the rebels what will happen if they don't have NATO support.
Yeah, that's right. And you were talking earlier about the support for the NATO intervention on the part of the political left, or on some of the political left, not all of it. But that part that supports it seems to have really entertained this fantasy that there's, you know, this mass uprising throughout North Africa and West Asia against Arab dictators and autocrats. And, I mean, that's the script of the uprisings in some places, for example, in Bahrain or Tunisia or in Egypt. But it doesn't apply in all cases. In Libya, it's a civil war, not the kind of uprising we've seen in Bahrain. If you're really interested in supporting uprisings against autocracy and dictators, then you should be interested in becoming active against the way the West is supporting, you know, Saudi Arabia and the Gulf Cooperation Council in violently putting down the uprising in Bahrain and within other Gulf monarchies.
Well, I found it kind of disappointing when the Libya situation was intensifying. I received an article, and that was the Gilbert Ashkar article saying that there should be a no-fly zone. There was also a collection of related articles, people making the argument that NATO likes Gaddafi. The United States likes Gaddafi. They're buddy-buddy because they have trade relations, and the U.S. is not going to intervene in Libya because they don't want the situation to change. And the rebels don't want foreign intervention. The rebels are independent, and they're trying to overthrow that government. That didn't seem to be the case. There were a variety of groups at the outset of this, but the people now that are driving around in the convoys, they're the ones that NATO has started to adopt, put under its shield or its umbrella. Now the U.S. has appointed one or two commanders, one of them who spent the last 20 years in Langley, Virginia, right? So there's a grooming of that movement. And it seems that, U.S. and NATO did want to get rid of Gaddafi, and that's why you have Obama saying that this operation shouldn't end until Gaddafi's gone, and Clinton making similar statements. But that doesn't appear to be the position of, well, a lot of people in Africa, including the African Union, and this is very interesting. I got some articles. If you go to Information Clearinghouse, they also bring some of the latest stuff. And they printed an article from The Guardian, and it talks about the African Union mission. They put together a peace treaty. This was composed of South Africa, Uganda, Mali, Mauritania, and Congo, and it's a four-point plan. And they're looking for a ceasefire, a peace plan, negotiations, and so forth. Now, the only mention I've heard of this in the Western press is that the rebels have rejected this kind of offer. So that's been rejected, but there was this AU mission. So I don't know. How much are you hearing about this? Are you hearing a lot about this African Union peace plan?
I don't hear a lot about it, and I think you don't hear a lot about it, certainly from the Western media, because the practice of the Western media is to report what's said at the White House and the State Department and the Pentagon, because it's cheap and easy to send reporters there and simply to repeat what you heard from official sources. They certainly don't have very many reporters covering the African Union. And they, even if they did, they would probably regard that news as being of little significance against anything that's being said at the White House or State Department or Pentagon. And as you point out, the African Union had proposed a ceasefire, which was rejected by the Benghazi rebels because their objective is the ouster of Gaddafi. So Gaddafi has to go. I mean, they're not particularly interested in peace. But then, I mean, that was the purpose of the uprising on their part, was to get rid of Gaddafi, so that's not so surprising. It's interesting, though, how Gaddafi is demonized. Many people on the left love demons because that allows, love to have people they could demonize. And certainly that's the case with Gaddafi, and the demonization has gone to extreme lengths. For example, suggesting that because the Libyan regime had trade with Western powers or allowed some investment, that somehow this meant that Gaddafi had become a lackey of the West. But there's a big difference between engaging strategically with the global economy, which is what Libya was doing, versus engaging unconditionally with the global economy and becoming a kind of subordinate component of it.
Well, you know, there's a lot of demonization that follows from these economic policies. No matter what choices Gaddafi makes, it seems to get him in trouble. In the case of the African Union peace plan, you know, some of the little reporting that's come out of it has been from The Guardian, which said that the peace plan is sort of poisoned or biased because a lot of those African countries involved in the peace plan are countries that received investment from Libya. So, you know, we can't trust that peace plan because I guess all of a sudden those 5, 6, 7, 8 countries are in the pocket of Gaddafi. So his choices or overall the government's investments in Africa are being used to further blame Libya and discredit a peace plan that's being put together in Africa.
Right, and at this point, any peace plan is going to be dismissed by Western media and Western officials because the game is changing the regime, so no one's interested in peace right now.
It's almost the same parties, U.S., France, Britain, and others that are, if you look at the issues of, you know, Israel-Palestine ceasefires, if you look at Turkey, if you look at the Gaza boat, it's always the same group that's opposing the rest of the world. It's always the U.S., France, Britain, etc. that's opposing the international community, in a sense. I think it was Pepe Escobar who was writing in Asia Times just the other day. He said, it's only the African Union that's acting like grown-ups. You know, they're the only ones that come out as adults in this particular issue. Now, I guess that's quite a lot to cover. It's interesting to see that the blaming of African mercenaries continues, and it just caught my attention that Chad has been blamed especially, and apparently the Chadian army has been accused by the rebels of, I guess, helping in some of their defeats, which is amusing because they're not directly involved, and that's hundreds of kilometers over desert supply lines that they'd have to be involved in order to affect things militarily. So there's a lot of flack going around on this issue, and I'm glad we have you to help clear up some of these things. I guess there's a few things we'll have to keep our eye out for, to see what degree anyone can push a peace plan forward, what France, Britain, and the United States are ultimately going to decide. I know that the United States is still conducting bombing missions, strike missions, even though they said they're going to get out of that about a week ago. There's still pressure on NATO to intensify ground strikes and so on. I guess it's hard to make predictions. Would you hazard a guess as to where you might see things going with France, United States, United Kingdom in making decisions on Libya?
Well, I think there's a possibility of a prolonged conflict. I think the United States perhaps has been reluctant to get involved. We've certainly seen that France and Britain have been the most aggressive. But it could be a prolonged conflict. I mean, how long did the no-fly zone over Iraq go on for?
Does sound ominous. In your case, you continued to look at Bahrain and how it's being treated, and also been looking at scholars of various peace institutes, what their position is towards regime change and what's been called nonviolent conflict. So I know there's going to be a continuing interesting commentary on your blog on this subject. We can reach that, and I believe this is right. It is gowans.wordpress.com. Is that's the address?
That's right.
Gowans.wordpress.com. That's what's left, and it's been catching, I would say, a higher degree of attention in the last few months because of Libya, because of Bahrain, the inconsistent stance of the United States on these interventions, and I look forward to seeing what you write on the future in this. So, Stephen, thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll catch you up later, and I'll mention your website address once again for our listeners.